This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that change exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to a brand new series of Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel back in time to revisit the audacious crimes of swindlers, hustlers, and women on the make. Women who were trying to make it in a world made for men. What do their lives and their crimes tell us about women in the past? And how different is it for women today? Now let me take you back more than 200 years to the beginning of the 19th century. Britain has been at war with France for over a decade. The war isn't going well. The economy's faltering. The future looks unsettled and full of fear. If you fell ill with a mysterious complaint that the local doctor couldn't cure, might you be tempted to turn to a charismatic woman who claims she has the power to heal and to vanquish evil too?
To escape the chambers of the grave, you must eat the pudding for 6 days. And you must put into it one of my powders every day.
The examination of this woman has disclosed a scene of complicated villainy on the one hand and of blind credulity on the other, which we believe has never been equaled.
It has pleased God to send me into the world that I might destroy the works of darkness.
In May 1806, a cloth merchant called William Perigo and his wife Rebecca live on the edge of Leeds in the north of England. They get a visit from Rebecca's niece, Sarah.
My aunt complained of a fluttering in her breast when she lay down, which the country doctor said had arisen from having an evil wish laid upon her. I mentioned a person I knew in Black Dog Yard in Leeds who I thought could cure her.
This person in Black Dog Yard is Mary Bateman, who'll become known as the notorious Yorkshire Witch. I want to know, does Mary Bateman believe that she has special powers to heal and to destroy the works of darkness? Or is she just a ruthless swindler? And what can Mary's story tell us about women and belief in the supernatural today? To help me answer these questions, I'm delighted to be joined by our guest detective, the writer and broadcaster Deborah Hyde, known to millions as the skeptical voice on the hit BBC podcast all about the supernatural, Uncanny. Deborah, welcome to Lady Swindlers.
It's wonderful to be here.
I described you just now as a skeptical voice. How would you describe yourself?
I think that's fair enough. I think that the whole subject of the uncanny and the supernatural is absolutely fascinating. I think it's a fantastic perspective on humans, on our nature. But I don't believe a word of it.
To find out more about Mary Bateman, I went with our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, to the part of Leeds where Mary Bateman was living at the very beginning of the 19th century.
Roz and I are in the lovely oasis in the city on this sunny day. We're in the churchyard.
But I say that, just over there, we've got a really busy road and there's the railway. We're actually in the heart of the city. What was it like in the early 19th century, Roz?
Well, Lucy, I brought with me a map for you. This is Leeds in 1792, so a few years before our case. We are at St. Peter's Church, which is here. Yeah, the Parish Church for Leeds becomes the Minster in 2012.
But look, it's right on the edge of the city, as all fields just here.
It is. The great thing about this map is it really shows you how small the town was at this time.
Yes, yeah. It's so teeny.
And then it grew hugely in the next few decades. Between 1790 and 1840, there's a real significant increase in population and urban growth.
This sounds like a fertile field for a lady swindler to me.
And of course, Mary was one of those people who were coming from outside of Leeds to this city in search of a better life.
Where was she born, do we know?
Yes, so she was born some distance away in Yorkshire in a little parish called Aisenby. Now, she leaves Aisenby at the age of 12 or 13, and she goes first to Thirsk and then to York. And she works as a domestic servant, but she also commits a string of petty offences. In 1788, she arrives in Leeds, and she starts to offer her services as a wise woman. So someone who will sell you charms to help you get things that you want, a little bit of fortune-telling, and also healing. In 1792, at the age of 24, she meets wheelwright John Bateman, and she marries him right here in this parish church.
Oh, just here.
Just
we're
here.
On the spot. Okay.
Yep. And I brought with me a copy of the marriage register, 26th of February, 1793. John Bateman of this parish marries Mary Harker, also of this parish, by license. John and Mary have 4 children,
yes.
But it's quite a turbulent marriage. So alongside this business as a wise woman, she's also stealing from her neighbours and swindling shopkeepers. And because of this, the family are forced to move around a lot to escape these angry neighbours. And they finally settle in a place called Black Dog Yard, just southeast of here, a neighbourhood of poorly built houses for poor factory workers. It was while they were here in Black Dog Yard that Mary comes up with a rather bizarre money-making scam. She claims that she has, wait for it, a prophetic hen.
Why don't I have a prophetic hen?
Who lays eggs with a special inscription on them. Christ is coming. So basically foretelling the second coming of Jesus. Now she charges visitors about a penny to come and see the hen laying these eggs. And now, of course, it was all fake.
No.
No. The words Christ is coming were inscribed on the eggs using corrosive vinegar. And then she would push it back up the hen's oviduct before the spectators turned up so they would see the egg coming out and being laid.
Oh, that's awful for the poor hen. Was. To what extent did early 19th century people still believe in magic and the supernatural?
In 1736, the Witchcraft Act, under which witchcraft was a crime punishable by death, was repealed. And it was replaced with new legislation which made pretense to witchcraft illegal.
Ah, so it's not illegal to be a witch, but the law now says it's illegal to pretend to be a witch.
Yes, exactly. In the early 19th century, we're really at the tail end of the period known as the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, which put an emphasis on rationalism and science. But actually, interest in magic persisted well into the 19th century. And it also had a practical purpose too, because this was a time when there was a lack of medical treatment for so many ailments, and doctors were really expensive. So these local healers continued to have an important role to play, and they weren't necessarily fraudulent.
Deborah Hyde, is there any law today in the UK relating to people who claim to have supernatural powers?
Yes, there is. There was the Fraudulent Mediums Act of 1951. That stopped people claiming to have mediumistic powers, and it was superseded in 2008 by legislation to protect people from unfair consumer trading practices. And so you can still have mass events where people show off their psychic powers on stage, but they have to say for entertainment purposes only, so that people know that they're not buying an unprovable product.
Oh, interesting.
Today, as in the early 19th century, we have that same feeling of uncertainty with wars raging and financial insecurity. Do you think that this makes the supernatural more attractive for some people now?
Well, there was an anthropologist called Bronislaw Malinowski, and he said that magic was the institutionalized expression of human optimism. We need some resilience, and it may well be that belief in magic provides a little bit of that.
So there's an overlap between belief in magic and hope for the future.
Yes, definitely, I think so.
Ah, I hadn't thought of it like that before. Interesting. Now back to Leeds. It's May 1806. The Perigo's niece Sarah is true to her word. Mary Bateman writes to William.
I can't cure your wife myself, but I have a friend at Scarborough, Miss Blythe, who can read the stars and collect from them knowledge requisite to remove all corporeal and mental maladies.
And soon afterwards, William receives a letter from this mysterious Miss Blythe herself.
I am sending 4 guinea notes in these bags, which you are to put in the bed that you and your wife sleep in. They are to remain there for 18 months, or they will do no good at all. You are to give 4 guinea notes to Mary Bateman.
And Miss Blythe issues a stern warning.
I will not take you under my hand, unless you promise never to mention a word of what is going on.
Now, we're talking here about a sort of lucky charm, something to put into the bed. Deborah Hyde, like the Perigos, many people today still believe in this sort of thing. Talismans, lucky mascots. It's pretty common, right?
It is. I think it's probably a fairly natural human kind of an instinct. The idea that there is a condensed quality within a subject. I mean, people pay money for books signed by authors and for posters signed by pop stars. So we do have an abstract sense of some kind of essence of something that is intangible and yet nonetheless it is there.
I think I can also understand the attraction of someone like Mary Bateman 200 years ago when doctors were expensive and possibly ineffective. But why do you think today, Deborah, that people turn to alternative therapies that aren't necessarily medically proven?
I think there's a sense of agency, something that you can perhaps do yourself. And it's not entirely bad.
There's nothing wrong with going and seeing somebody who's not medically qualified. They can give you time, they can give you attention, they can give you care, and that might help. Do you think that women are particularly drawn to alternative therapies because sometimes they've been left out of conventional medicine that's been more centred on men? Things like female heart attacks are underdiagnosed because people are looking for the male symptoms.
The world is built around a male as a model for a human being. It even works with the design of seatbelts, for example. It's only been in the last 40 years or so that women have even been mandatorily included on clinical trials for new drugs.
Now, let's get back to our case. The mysterious Miss Blythe demands more money for bags of charms. Fancy that. And William ends up sending her, via Mary Bateman, more than £70. That's a lot of money in 1806. It's close to the annual income for a skilled tradesman. But, according to Mary Bateman, if Miss Blythe is to cure Rebecca Perigo, then she needs more than just money. Over the course of 6 months, Mary Bateman sends William an extraordinary shopping list of the things that he needs to buy for Miss Blythe, including
a new bed and all the necessary appendages. 2 pairs of men's shoes, a tea caddy, a set of china, a counterpane, a piece of woollen cloth, a silk handkerchief, 2 napkins, 3 bottles of spirits, 2 tablecloths, 2 barrels, a fender, several hat boxes, 2 pounds of malt, a piece of beef, a cheese of 8 pounds in weight, 60 pounds of butter, 200 or 300 eggs, a goose, and 4 pounds of bacon.
Well, Miss Blythe in Scarborough certainly won't be going hungry. Deborah, these are astonishing amounts of money and goods that the Perigos are handing over. They're clearly under a spell of some sort. Do you think that Mary must have had a very strong and convincing personality?
I think she must have. And I think, in fact, if you're going to provide supernatural services, then all you have is your personality. And the people who will succeed can make people believe things.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachim.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
Back to our story. At this point, the spring of 1807, a year after Mary first meets the Perrigos, the story gets darker, I'm afraid. The Perrigos receive a very worrying letter from Miss Blythe.
My dear friends, I am sorry to tell you that you will take an illness in the month of May. To escape the chambers of the grave, you must eat pudding for 6 days, and you must put into it one of my powders every day.
The Perrigos dutifully take the powders in their pudding. For the first 5 days, nothing happens. But the packet of powder marked for the 6th day is bigger than the others. William is horrified by its taste.
I ate a single mouthful, but it was so noxious that I could eat no more of it. My wife, however, swallowed 3 or 4 mouthfuls of it. Her tongue swelled and she was seized with the most violent vomitings. My wife said it was the illness predicted by Miss Blythe, and she would not hear of a doctor being called because that was contrary to Miss Blythe's directions.
The next day, Sunday the 24th of May, 1807, Rebecca Perrigo dies. One of William's neighbours gives some of the leftover pudding to a cat, which dies. And when some of the hens eat it, they die as well. I must say there's far too much cruelty to chickens in this story. William still doesn't go to the authorities. Instead, I hardly believe this, he turns once again to Mary Bateman and to Miss Blythe, who blames him for his wife's death and demands even more money. Now, Deborah, this is turning very dark and sinister here. A woman has died. I can see why Mary Bateman ends up being known to history as the Yorkshire Witch. Let me ask you a bit about modern witchcraft. It's big on social media and it has a big commercial arm today too. People selling candles, crystals, charms, just like Mary Bateman, in fact. Deborah, what does it mean to be a witch now, today?
Well, it means something very different to what it did originally. It's a spiritual practice. It was taken up by second wave feminists in the 70s as a way of having a female type of religion. And a lot of women seem to be very, very attracted to it now.
It gives them power, it gives them agency, it gives them control. Back to the story. Finally, in October 1808, so that's a whole year and 4 months after his wife's death, William Perrigo's faith in Mary Bateman and the mysterious Miss Blythe runs out. And as he's probably pretty desperate for cash by now, he's keen to retrieve those bags full of money.
On the 19th of October, I opened up the bed in which all the bags were sewn up, and having opened the whole of them, I found no money whatever.
He goes into Leeds to confront Mary Bateman.
There is nothing in the bags but bits of lead, plain paper, bad halfpennies and bad farthings.
It is your fault. You have opened them too soon.
No, I think I've opened them too late.
The next day, William at last goes to the authorities. When Mary Bateman is arrested, they find in her house a huge number of the Perrigo's possessions, including William's china, his tea caddy, his fender, his barrel, and several hat boxes. But all the food, well, that's long gone. It's gone into the bellies of the Bateman family. Mary is also in possession of a poisonous white powder, corrosive sublimate of mercury. Mary is charged with willful murder, and she's taken to the prison at York Castle, where she now waits 6 months for her trial. Deborah, I'm amazed it took William Perigot all that long time to lose faith in Mary and to go to the authorities. Is that something that you're not surprised by?
Psychologists talk about the sunk cost fallacy, where you just throw more effort or more money at something which you have already invested an unpleasant amount into. You think that just a little bit more and it will all work.
Mary's trial takes place on the 17th of March, 1809. She has no legal representation and she makes no defence, apart from denying the charge of willful murder of Rebecca Perigo. And you will not be astonished to learn that the letters from Miss Blythe to the Perigos are shown in court to have been written in Mary Bateman's handwriting. The jury, who are all male, almost instantly decide that she's guilty of murder, and the judge delivers his sentence.
You shall be taken on Monday next to the place of execution, there to be hanged by the neck until you are dead, and that your body be given to the surgeons to be dissected and anatomized. And may God Almighty have mercy on your soul.
I went with Ros Crone to York Castle Prison. It's now part of York Castle Museum, to hear the end of Mary's story. We're now in what appears to be a Victorian street. It's been lovingly recreated with all these shops and businesses and so on. But this was all built in what used to be the exercise yard at the prison. So where we're standing, Mary herself could have been taking exercise. We could be following in her actual footsteps. And Ros, what do you think it was like for Mary for those 6 or so months that she was imprisoned here?
Where we're standing, this was the site of the female prison, and it was relatively new. It had only been built in the 1780s. We know that Mary was allowed to take her youngest child into the prison with her.
Oh.
Because she was still breastfeeding.
Gosh.
And we also know from the newspapers that while she was in prison, awaiting her trial, she apparently conned a fellow female prisoner who was desperate for a visit from her sweetheart. Mary offers to sew a sum of money into the underwear of her fellow prisoner.
Like, oh,
a charm.
Here we go again.
Yeah. But of course, she kept the money. Now, when she had been convicted and she was put in the condemned cell, we know that she writes a letter to her husband. And in that letter, she puts her wedding ring as a gift for her daughter.
Oh.
And she also admits to numerous frauds that she had committed, but she still denies murder.
So it's the 20th of March, 1809. What happens that day?
We know that when she leaves her cell, her baby's asleep, and so she kisses it and leaves it on her bed and then walks out. So it's quite heartbreaking. And we also know that many thousands of people came to watch her execution.
And then her body is dissected. Tell me about this. Was it unusual?
It's important to note that dissection was part of the punishment. And if we think about popular ideas about the body at that time, that you needed to have a whole body in order to enter heaven, you can see how that the denial of this to murderers was basically a sign that they were going straight to hell.
Was it also done for the edification of medical students?
Exactly. There was a need for bodies for scientific study.
Huh.
And female bodies were in particular demand because of the relative rarity of female murderers. Mary's body was sent to the Leeds General Infirmary, and members of the public were charged 3 pence to come and see it opened up.
And how does all this get reported in the press?
As well as all the reporting in the press, numerous biographies of Mary Bateman were written. And I've brought one with me to show you today. See this one here? The Extraordinary Life and Character of Mary Bateman, the Yorkshire Witch. 56 pages long, and here it includes a portrait of Mary Bateman.
Oh, she's got a bottle of poison. Oh, and is that one of the eggs from the magical hen?
It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Christ is coming. But on a more serious note, What's interesting is the way that the newspapers really sneer at people who still believe in this magical stuff. So, for example, the press describe William Perrigo as a dupe, and this case as the most unprecedented instance of credulity. What they also do, they dig up lots of other cases of families being swindled by Mary in ways similar to Perrigo's. Most shocking of all, it comes to light that in 1803, 5 years before the death of Rebecca Perrigo, three members of the Kitchen family, they were local shopkeepers and friends of Mary's, they died suddenly after taking medicine that had been prepared by Mary. And to add insult to injury, after their death, Mary used her key to completely clear out their house of all their possessions.
So, Deborah, Mary Bateman, definitely a swindler, possibly also a killer. Can you imagine if she were alive today what sort of thing she might be getting up to?
Oh, I think she'd be running psychic shows with For Entertainment Purposes only written across the poster. I think she'd also be on the internet and selling all sorts of lucky charms and probably selling spells that she could put through the ether to give people their wishes.
Now, Roz has joined us in the studio. Hello, Roz.
Hello, Lucy. And hello, Deborah.
Roz, what do you take away from this story? Did Mary, do you think, really believe that she had supernatural powers?
No, not at all. No. Mary was not just a wise woman, but she was also a habitual petty thief, right? She stole from her employers, her neighbours, and also her clients. Her dealings with the Perrigos were entirely fraudulent, okay? Miss Blythe, that wise woman up in Scarborough, she was just completely made up. She didn't sew the money into the little bags at all. She kept the money and she spent it. The murder's crucial here. The murder of Rebecca Perrigo, which brought all of this swindling to light and exposed it. But I think what we mustn't do here is to extrapolate from this that all wise women were fraudulent, because some of their remedies may have even offered relief and their magic could soothe even if it didn't solve. But I do think that her story then becomes this tool for the more educated in society, the more sceptical, to discredit and even mock the supernatural beliefs of more ordinary people.
Yes, there's a whole lot of victim shaming going on here. Deborah, what do you take away from the story?
Because medicine wasn't effective, really, until late 19th, early 20th centuries, you can see why they went to wise women, why they relied on wise women. But even so, really, I think it's fair to call Mary a kleptomaniac, and certainly to have kind of sociopathic levels of lack of empathy with the suffering she caused.
Now, I'm afraid there's a final gruesome twist to this tale. After the public dissection, Mary's skeleton was put on display in a museum in Leeds, where it stayed until incredibly recently, 2015. For me, Mary's story shows the really interesting tension between modernity and superstition two centuries ago. I think Mary Bateman did have a sort of magical power, a supreme self-confidence which helped her to get away with her three-decade career as a fraudster. She was a bad un, but she must also have had a remarkable ability to give sick and anxious people the attention they craved at a time when medicine was expensive and unreliable. And with the stuttering economy and with war just over the horizon, Mary's victims had to live with terrible uncertainty. They were desperate for reassurance. Doesn't that just remind you of us today? Well, a huge thank you to Deborah Hyde, Professor Rosalind Crone, and York Museums Trust. Next time on Lady Swindlers, we meet an elegant con artist who used over 40 aliases to amass a fortune. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. The historical consultant is Rosalind Crone. The commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts, and the executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with Lady Swindlers weekly on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hi, Greg.
Hi, Greg.
Hi, Greg.
I'm Greg Foot, and my BBC Radio 4 show Sliced Bread is back to investigate more of your suggested wonder products and find out if the latest fads really deliver on their bold claims.
It just seems a bit too good to be true.
Once again, I'll be talking to the experts and separating the science fact from the marketing fiction.
They're duped into thinking that it's something that has a degree of scientific rigour when it just doesn't.
From jet lag products and home allergy tests to how a plant-based banger compares to a regular meat sausage.
Some tasted like cardboard.
Sliced Bread with me, Greg Foot. And to make sure you hear my new batch of investigations first, go search for Sliced Bread on BBC Sounds.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that change exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.